history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some pretty incredible stories just waiting to be told if we'll take a little time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in a place that you might not find on the map. You got to know how to get to Creston, California. And Tom Hidalgo certainly does. He is 97 years old. Lived here for about 10 years, but you grew up in another beautiful spot, Tom, Santa Barbara. What was Santa Barbara like on the California coast in the 1920s and 30s? Tell me about your childhood there.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about my birthplace in Santa Barbara. I was born at 825 Canal Street. Later on, maybe a couple years, 1922, we had a visit from the King of Belgium, and he donated to Santa Barbara the first olive trees in Santa Barbara, and they planted them all along Canal Street. So Canal Street lost its name, and it became Olive, and it's Olive Street today.
Santa Barbara is a big tourist spot now. Obviously, people love the beaches, and they flock to the historic mission there that's hundreds of years old. How much of that mission was still intact when you were growing up?
Very much like it is, because during the earthquake, I think it was 1925 or somewhere around that area, they rebuilt the mission because most of it came down during the earthquake.
So you were a little kid when that earthquake happened?
Yes. At that time, I lived on the opposite side of town. I lived on the west side of town on Mitchelterranea and Almond Avenue.
So what do you remember about the earthquake? Did you feel it?
I remember we lived in a two-story house running out onto Almond Avenue along with everybody else in the neighborhood. Everybody came out of their houses, out on the streets. Most of the town or the older buildings, like where the Fox Arlington Theater is now, there used to be the Arlington Hotel.
So there was some significant damage in Santa Barbara from that quake.
A lot of damage in Santa Barbara. There was a lot of reconstruction went on there. It led to what it is today.
And what about you as a kid? What were the things that you spent your time doing? Did you have to work from a pretty young age? Were you out playing around, or what were you doing?
Being Hispanic, my father taught us that we should learn Spanish at home. He said, English, you're going to learn at the school. I went to school with a fellow, his last name was Hatlin. He was from Denmark, and we started Wilson Kindergarten together. He didn't know any English. I didn't know any English, and so the teacher in kindergarten put us together. How we got along, I don't know, but we managed to play together, and we stayed in high school. He died about 2 years ago. We were friends all those years.
I know it's a long time ago, but you seem like you have a pretty sharp memory. So do you remember what your dreams or ambitions were, what you thought, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to be or I'm going to do?
I like music. I guess most Hispanics do. So I took up being a musician. I started out by learning how to play the violin. And then later on, when we grew up a little older and the big name bands came on the scene, I took up the tenor sax and the clarinet. I used to play at one of the local spots. Well, there were two places. One was the El Paseo. That was quite a restaurant in there, and I played there. I also played out at Cantina or Beer Gardens. We used to play on Sunday afternoons at these beer garden places. I even got to play down as far as Santa Paula and Ventura.
Was there a signature song you liked to play or that you were the best at?
Oh, no, we just played whatever the big name bands played. We tried to imitate them.
And I understand music was a part of your military journey, but before you got in the military, you met a special someone who was going to be a part of your life for more than 7 decades. Tell me about how you met your late wife, Jenny.
I was from the La Cumbre, the North Junior High in town, and she was going to Santa Barbara Junior High. I was starting high school, she was starting junior high, and we met at a track meet between the two schools. Cousin of mine introduced me to her, and we just hit it off from that day on. I took time out from the service, came home, and married her before I got shipped overseas.
Well, let's talk about how you ended up in the service. Did you go in before Pearl Harbor?
Yes, I was in 1941. I joined the National Guard because we used to get paid $1 a drill, and $1 was went a long ways at that time. Every Monday, would go to National Guard drill, and you'd get paid every 3 months. And it got federalized. We were artillery, so we got sent up to Fort Lewis.
Fort Lewis, Washington. So is that where you were on December 7th? What do you remember about that day?
I was in the band at that time. We were reading the Post-Intelliger newspaper that was from Seattle. We were laying around on the bunks when they interrupted the program to tell us that Pearl Harbor was being bombed. Of course, immediately the call to arms was sounded throughout the 41st Cantonment, which was the area north Fort Lewis at that time. We were all called to draw our arms and get prepared. That afternoon, we moved our artillery pieces down to Grace Harbor, take the position of coast artillery, because we didn't know whether the Japanese were going to come into Seattle or not.
And that sounds crazy to people now because they don't, you know, they've never heard of the Japanese coming to the Pacific Northwest. But at the time, for you, that must have been a real threat and probably pretty hair-raising to imagine.
Lately, I've read where there was a couple Japanese planes that were finally discovered there, where they had flown into parts of Alaska there. We didn't hear about that going on until much later, when they went into Dutch Harbor, I think it was, one of those places up there. And then part of the troops in Fort Lewis were sent up to Alaska.
And I wonder if you heard about at the time, something I'm sure you know about now, but one of the places where the Japanese actually did come to the West Coast was your hometown. They had a sub that fired a shell right toward Santa Barbara there.
Oh, yes, out at Elwood. Of course, I wasn't in Santa Barbara at that time, but I remember reading about it. My wife sent me clippings of the paper. They had talked about the shelling of some of the oil derricks out there at Elwood.
And so here, you know, you joined the National Guard for $1 a drill, and now you're playing your saxophone for the Army, but now you're at war. Was that hard to get used to or hard to swallow? How did that change things for you?
Well, I felt that I could do a better job of fighting the enemy with a weapon instead of a saxophone and a clarinet. Although we played for a lot of parades and bond rallies and launching of ships up along the Sound there. So I transferred from the band, the 144th Artillery Band, which is the 980th Field Artillery, a Long Tom outfit.
I'm thinking most people listening have probably never heard a Long Tom go off. Can you explain to us what that gun is like when you're next to it and it's firing?
Well, it has quite a sharp report to it. It's separate loading ammunition. Ram in the projectile, depending on the range. You put in so many bags of powder behind that projectile, and then you close the breech, and it's fired by a little shell. It ignites the big powder bag, which causes the explosion and propels the projectile out. It had a range of approximately 10 miles.
That's a long way, and it's also a pretty big projectile. How big were those things?
The projectile weighs 95 pounds. We didn't call it by pounds. Each projectile has little squares on it, and 4 squares is the maximum weight of the projectile. And, of course, you're selective as to what projectile you put in to put the appropriate charge to propel it a set distance.
And how is that on your ears? Did you have some protection for your ears?
A lot of people used ear suppressants to dull the impulse, because after that projectile, it's kind of like a vacuum, and then the air rushes back in again. So it's kind of hard on your ears, but you get used to it after a while. I worked in the computation of setting the elevation and the deflection. Deflection is east and west, or for direction, and the other one is for altitude of the depression or the elevation of the tube to launch it, you know, like lobbing a football.
So
you have to get it to spiral like you do a football in order to keep it in its trajectory.
Are you saying you were working on the gun to set those, or you were giving them the settings to apply to the guns?
I was giving them the setting, computing, using a slide rule and firing tables to know what elevation and what deflection.
So that's a lot of responsibility. You're the one that's basically telling them, if you set these settings at these spots, you're going to hit the target. But whether or not you're right or wrong has a lot to do with whether people live or die.
Well, my job was as an operations sergeant during the war. I took the information off the map, put it on my slide rule, and through manipulation there, you came out with the firing data to put on the guns to get it to shoot where you wanted it to.
How many people do you think right now who are listening to this know what a slide rule is or have ever seen one?
Well, there's a lot of people. There was a lot of artillery and different calibers. Because even the tanks had an artillery piece on them.
So you're doing all this in training. You're probably figuring that at some point you're going to have to go overseas, right?
Yes, we had quite a bit of training, and then we joined Patton's group out on the desert, out at Granite Mountain, out on the desert. Of course, some big open spaces there. We could really get to shoot 10, 15 miles, you know. So we got a lot of good training before we went overseas.
And I've heard stories about the Mojave Desert and that training with Patton's guys. In fact, my grandfather was there. I've heard that those tanks ground up the sand pretty fine and then it would blow. Did you experience any of those sandstorms out there?
Yeah, there were quite a few sandstorms out there at the time. Of course, today we have Fort Irwin out there, which is heaven now to what it used to be.
Well, you want to give us a taste of that? What was it like back then? What did you experience there?
You had one canteen of water, and you had to make it last all day. I had a lot of people from the East Coast that were in our battalion. I taught them a little trick about picking up a little stone and putting it in your mouth to keep the saliva going. That kept you from having to drink all that water all at one time and then going thirsty.
I'm sure there are people that are listening to that right now, and that'll probably come in handy for them sometime. But who taught you that trick?
I think I got it from my grandpa. My grandpa was part Indian. That went along with their boyhood. The Indians knew that. They learned to live that way.
What tribe was he from?
I don't really know. He must have been an Apache or something like that, because he traveled across the border. Sometimes they were living in the United States, sometimes they were over in Mexico. The only people that I know that were doing that were the Apaches.
And you decided, and I'm interested in how this thinking worked for you, because you told us about meeting Jenny when she's in junior high. And some guys, when they were about to go overseas, they were a little afraid to get married because they weren't sure they were coming back. What made you decide that, hey, it's time to do this now?
Well, she was the one that wanted to get married. And while I was at Fort Sill, I got leave, came home and got married in Santa Barbara, took her with me. At that time, I was stationed. It's a big artillery range now back in the southeast part of Washington, Yakima. Down below there was an Indian reservation, a little place called Toppenish.
So you took her with you to Yakima?
Yes. And when I was still in the van, by the way, and I used to play the dances at the Donley Hotel there in Yakima. And there was a fellow that played the accordion, Tommy Myers, I think was his name. He lived in Yakima.
And when did you guys get married?
42.
And then when did you go overseas?
Right after that. I went to Fort Leonard Wood. From Fort Leonard Wood, we went to Camp Miles Standish in Massachusetts. And from there, we went to ship to England.
Well, I bring it up just because I'm curious. Most of us have never been in a situation like that. But here you are, you're a young guy, you've got this new bride, and now you're heading overseas. Did you really think that you were going to come back?
I had something to come back to. Well, we had a lot of close calls and all that, but I guess the Lord was with me, and here I am. Because a few years later, I went to Korea.
Well, and you were also involved in one of the biggest military operations of all time, and certainly a day that I'm sure you can't forget, that everybody talks about, the longest day, June 6th of 44. But what about the buildup to that? I'm sure you were in England for a while getting ready for that.
Yes, we went there and calibrated our brand new weapons that we got, because we didn't take the ones we had in the States. There were some already pre-positioned in England. So when we got to England, we trained with the Canadians and the British forces. We went to their artillery range, which is called Lark Hill.
And did you have any idea what was about to happen or what they were building towards?
Well, we knew that if we were going to go into Europe itself, France and Belgium and those countries, that we were going to have to. And we had several feints. We boarded ships and took a cruise looking like we were going to go, but it was further down along the Atlantic coast, never at Cherbourg.
But did you know that those were feints, that those were practices or false alarms, or did you think it was the real deal?
We thought that were the real thing. Nobody knew that. Somebody had to know. Because we just went out there. Germans send their submarines out. Yeah, we lost a couple ships, and we lost some people, but nobody ever mentioned that.
Did you see that happen? You saw ships go down?
Well, no, I didn't. Generally, while we were on board the ship, we kept training people, because you never knew. You have to train two or three deep, because you never know when you're going to lose somebody, and then you can't operate because you're missing one cog, you know.
Sure.
So you have to have spares.
Well, I know some people have probably heard about Operation Tiger and Slapton Sands, where there was a big practice invasion and the Germans showed up and picked a bunch of people off. And that was a disaster. And what you're talking about, you guys go out there and you don't even know that it's not the real deal yet, but you do know your life's in danger and there are German submarines in the area. How frightening or nerve-wracking was that?
You didn't have time to think about what you thought was, I'm here to do a job, and I've got to do the best I can. I never thought about I'm not going to make it. I always thought I'm going to make it.
And he did, and maybe that's part of why he did. Time for our first break, but we have much more to come with 97-year-old Tom Hidalgo of Creston, California. The invasion of Normandy, the Battle of the Bulge, and the big surprise he had waiting for him when he came home from the war. Check out photos and a short video of Tom at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.